Is cromulent a Simpsons word?
It is. Cromulent is a Simpsons word. Yeah.
It makes me think of like an alien race from Star Trek, like the Romulans, the Cromulans.
I don't know. I'm not a star anything person, honestly, but
No space for Stacy. That's it. No space, Stace.
no, definitely not.
Hello and welcome to Let's Pod This, friends. Welcome back. My name is Andy Moore. I am your host, joined by my co-host, Emily Stacey. Hello, Emily.
Hey.
Hello. Great. Thanks for being here. Friends, it's hot. Ooh, doggies, it's hot. The weather, the heat should break this weekend. The heat dome is moving on, I believe. But we are smack dab in the middle of, I guess, primary election season, right? We're roughly equidistant between the primary in June and the primary runoff in August. And then after that, it's just another 2 months, really, as that last dash to the general election in November. And it's, you know, it's summertime, I think, Emily, like political news is, it's feast or famine, right?
It is. Yeah, very much so. You got to kind of hope for some manna from heaven to drop somebody to, you know, the scandalousness, right? You know, the surprises after our primary election, certainly. But yeah, things have sort of dried up just a little bit, although we did have some news, I think, this week in terms of our runoff election and, you know, some of the candidates or the candidate. Refusing to debate, which I thought was interesting. If you saw the non-doc article, apparently Maisie is refusing to do a televised debate before the runoff election, which I think for me, again, points to the fact that I'm really surprised. And you know me, I'm an avid Jeopardy watcher. Of course, last week was a holiday week. I've not seen any of those.
Does what? That mean that there's not Jeopardy on holiday weeks? Is that what that?
No, there's Jeopardy, but the holiday week was more for the election, right? The election pontificating less so about Jeopardy. No, the Olympics, you know, they're World usually Cup. The only special events that, you know, up in Jeopardy.
Oh, that's fair. So you're exactly right, and I love that you jumped into this. I think today we're going to talk about, I've got three things on the agenda.
Yeah,
which you already know because I sent them to you this morning. But the first one is about the primary runoff, the Republican primary runoff for governor, and then just kind of like elections more broadly. We'll talk about legislators who have been wading into the pool to start endorsing some candidates, and some organizations and philanthropists as well. So just let's talk about like election dynamics there. And then maybe we'll wrap up with a conversation about data centers and how it may affect the election, both the runoff and the general election. Does that sound good?
Yeah.
I'll tell you what we're not going to talk about. Graham Plattner.
Look, I love that the Democrats can always find a way to shoot themselves in the foot. And the fact that, you know, this individual candidate is, speaking of feet, dragging his until the very last day and forcing the main Democratic Party effectively to convention this nonsense out, because they've got six people who want this candidacy. What a shit show, Andy.
Well, it's so, you know, I think you probably know, and listeners of the show know, that one of my weekly podcasts that I consume is the GD Politics podcast. Galen Druk is the host of that. He used to be the host of the 538 Politics podcast, RIP. But this week, Galen had on two guests that I didn't really know, Lakshi Jain and Zachary Donnany. And I may be mispronouncing one or both of those, but it was really interesting that Lakshi's from The Argument and Zachary is from Vote Hub. And so they really discussed how Plattner's departure may shake up control of the Senate. And one of them, I forget which one it was, but one of them in the cold open described Graham Plattner as a rich person's idea of what a working class person is.
Exactly.
And then I was like, oh, that's interesting.
Charles just McCall?
McCall.
Did you get elements of Charles McCall? Good.
Right. Oh, right. I mean, but I think McCall is like was trying to cosplay as a working man. And
Plattner, that's fair. I think actually, that's fair.
Yeah. Is a working man, except the follow-up comment is that the same guy said they basically found the town drunk and forced him to run for the U.S. Senate. And I was like, oh, okay. So I like laughed out loud in my car. Anyway, I said we're not going to talk about Graham Plattner. Here we are. My point in this is that when it's political news, it's feast or famine. My colleagues in Maine are getting just a deluge of news I have, you know, some friends that work in Maine politics, and on the plus side, there's a ton of polling in Maine that they don't normally have for the governor's race, some of these other down ballot races now, because, you know, people are polling the Plattner race. And so they go ahead and ask some other questions. Mm-hmm. So, you know, there's like this knock on effect, I think, about having a top of the ticket race can color stuff going down the ballot, which is the tie in here is let's talk about the GOP primary runoff here. So everyone knows, right? It's Mike Mazie versus Gittner Drummond going into the runoff. From all accounts, they are fairly neck and neck. They were mostly neck and neck going into the primary. Drummond, I think, in the polling that we had a slight lead going into the primary. And I think it's somewhat expected that he might still have a slight lead. However, we don't know because we don't have that kind of polling.
Nope.
It's weird to say we don't have Maine level polling in Oklahoma. But just as we're just a few weeks out, well, like 6 weeks out, I guess, from the August election, now is the time that these two candidates are having to draw bright lines in the sand about who they are in this effort to appeal to, I'll say, Republican voters, but it's not, they're not really appealing to all Republican voters, are they?
No, they are not. No, it's a very niche group, right? The very fervent, the religious, if you will, but not necessarily in a religious sense. Those who come out and they vote early, they vote often, they vote every time. So these are the dyed-in-the-wool conservatives. And with that, Mazie has the advantage, right? Turnout for primaries and runoffs are typically incredibly low, especially in a low turnout state like Oklahoma. And so you're getting, right, those real diehard, you know, whatever party it is, conservatives or liberals coming out. And I think at this point it bodes well for Mazie. What I don't know bodes well for Mazie is that Kevin Stitt endorsement, quite honestly. I would be interested. We need to get on Pat McFerrin or somebody. I need some numbers. I would suspect, right, because as you mentioned, not only were they neck and neck, you know, in polling, but in the actual results of the primary, right? It was, a percentage and a half, maybe. It was not more than 2 percentage points that separated them.
Separated the two of them?
Yes.
Yeah, I'm pulling up right now. It was pretty close, but I remember it was a pretty crowded field, right? So
it was, but also Chip Keating was the next one. They were, 20 something, 25, 24 point something, and then Keating was at 17.
Yeah, so so Drummond got 26.25 mm-hmm. and Mazie got 25.97. So it was very close.
It was
105. Drummond got 105,832 votes. So 105,832 versus Mazie's 104,691. Essentially like 1,200 votes separate them out of 400,000 that were cast in that race. And so, the real question, right, is like, where do the voters go who were voting for all those other candidates?
Right. Merrick goes to Mazie. McCall goes to Mazie. I think it's the Keating votes that will be interesting to see where those separate. I think a good portion of the Keating votes are going to stay establishmentarian, and I think they go to Drummond, honestly. They're going to go with somebody who is known, trusted, who has been statewide for a long time, who has an incredibly, you know, storied public record. And not that Mazie doesn't. He obviously has a public record. but not in the same way that obviously an attorney general of the state of Oklahoma has. So I think just based on the type of conservative that, you know, the Keating name is, right, and associates with, I feel like a lot of those voters are going to be the older core, right, a more commonsensical establishmentarian, Reaganite, if you will, conservatives. So,
but I think you're right, except this is like a recalculation I've been doing is we talk about it like, okay, all of those votes are going to go to this guy and all of these votes are going to go to this other guy, but that is not the case because not all of those votes are going to vote.
No, exactly. So
I look back at 2018, right, which was the last time we had an open seat for governor. It was a very similar kind of deal. We had Kevin Stitt, obviously, was running and won. You had Lieutenant Governor Todd Lamb. You had Oklahoma City Mayor Mick Cornett. Those were the top three vote getters. And in fact, in the primary in 2018, Mayor Mick got the most votes. He got 29.34%. Lamb and Stitt got, Stitt and Lamb got 24 and 23%, but they were real close, just a few thousand votes there. But it meant that Todd Lamb, who was long expected to be one of the front runners and kind of was, but you know, if you're not first or second, you're last in the primary. And so he lost out. And then it went to a runoff with just Stitt and Cornett. Obviously Stitt came from behind and won because of that realignment. And just for the sake of numbers, Emily, I'll tell you in 2018, in the primary, the June primary, there were 452,000 votes cast. And these are all Republicans because they have closed primaries.
Yeah.
And then the runoff, it dropped down by a big chunk, down to 302,000 votes. So that's a pretty significant change, right?
Yeah.
And so if we see a similar drop in the June primary this year, we had right around 400,000 votes cast. And so if we saw a similar drop, then we should expect somewhere like, 250,000 or 280,000 like that, but still like a big drop off. And who in the Republican coalition turns out, I think, is the ball game.
I agree. Another set of data points that I think will be interesting to kind of watch for are those independents, right? Not only you had roughly 3,500 independents who changed their registration to vote Republican in the primary. So again, not just conservatives who are disenchanted or disaffected by the primary results, but how many of those 3,500 independents are going to continue on and use that power that they now have as Republicans in that runoff election, and who will they vote for if they do? So you've got about 3,500 Oklahomans in a very tight election that could make a huge difference.
Yeah, so this is, I had not thought about this, and my brain is like reeling right now because I think you're exactly right. You mentioned independents, and I was like, what's the big deal? We got closed primaries, they can't vote.
But
there are independents and Democrats who switched to become Republicans because they said they wanted to have more of a say in who gets. And so I would imagine, I've not done the surveys, but I would imagine if you are a voter who is motivated enough to change your party affiliation so you can vote in the primary, you are probably also motivated enough to vote in the primary runoff.
I would almost think that the runoff is more important than the primary to you at this point. So I'm looking at a KOCO story that came out on June 12th, so just right after we had our primary. And again, it's
Before, right? Primary was June 16th, so right before the primary?
Or I'm sorry, right before, yes. My bad. Time is a construct. 9,000 independent voters changed overall ahead of our primary on June 16th. Thank you, Andy. 5,300 roughly independents changed to Democrat since the start of 2026. And again, another 3,529 independents switched to Republican. So again, a big shift to Democrats, which also could you know, obviously they'll have time before the general election to switch back if they want. But I mean, whatever, it doesn't really matter because you can vote however, right? Well, I think it also could mean something for Cindy Munson down the road. We can have that conversation later, but I do think it's an interesting data point, honestly, that Oklahomans are using their power at the ballot or at, you know, registration, like I advocated for, you know, a few months ago. Like, yeah.
Well, and this is, I mean, this is obviously like clearly a problem with closed primaries, is that all this conversation is about these two candidates from one party. There is a Democrat in the race who is a very formidable candidate, right? Who will, I mean, I think at worst probably garner 40% of the vote. Like there's kind of a floor for Democrats of 35 to 40%, right? So
I'm not putting a floor on this election depending on who comes out the Republican candidate. And I'm gonna just leave my statement at that for now. But I'm not counting Cindy Munson out this year.
No, I'm saying floor, like at worst.
Oh, yeah, I'm sorry.
Like, look, you know, generic ballot.
Parts of houses, they're all constructs.
Yeah. So I'm just meaning like generic ballot, any Democrat is gonna get 35-40% of the vote in the general. And then there's three independents, none of whom I don't think that I've tried to Google them. They're not super compelling. I imagine will each get a few thousand votes because that's usually how it goes. But in 2018, the runoff was basically 45-55. So there was a separation of just under 30,000, like 27,000 votes. So still a pretty big gap. And, you know, Kevin Stitt was an outsider who really came in with not much baggage because no one knew him. Like, we were like, who is this guy? He ran a bank. Oh, he's an outsider. Okay.
Wheeler.
But Mayor Mick was very well known, at least in Oklahoma City, not the rest of the state necessarily, but was pretty well known to be kind of a moderate Republican. I think that's how a lot of people viewed him. I knew a lot of Democrats who were enthused about him but weren't allowed to vote.
Yeah.
And then the campaign was hard for him. He could run as this, like, you know, moderate Republican in the primary because he couldn't occupy the far right space.
Right.
But once he got into the runoff, it left open the door for this unknown guy, Stitt, to kind of cannibalize or to collect all of those farther right votes. And, you know, and we saw Cornette really struggle. There was the Bull Stitt ad at the end that I think actually hurt him, especially with older voters, because they didn't felt it was vulgar.
Yeah. It killed him. Look, Stitt rode on, that was a really great election year, right? I mean, 26, this way, he rode the national wave and continued, right? I mean, if we really want to talk about the infiltration of national politics into the state of Oklahoma, it came with Kevin Stitt and him riding that sort of MAGA wave into Oklahoma and just... I mean, it's been an infestation of national politics in our lovely little state, you know, for the last decade or so. And it's, I will, and again, I blame Florida, right? Because he, you know, was Floridian. Just saying. I will be really excited to have a governor that's native. Who knows and understands, right? Yeah. Dude, I don't know why I'm such a purist about this. I don't know. Oklahoma is such a unique state, and our politics are so unique. The tribes, even the flavors of conservatism and the way that our Dixiecrats, like the entire political history of this state is so unique. And I feel like folks who were not born and raised, who are not, you know, who didn't take those field trips up to the Oklahoma Cowboy Hall of Fame, now the National whatever Heritage Museum. If you were not socialized in Oklahoma, I feel like it's hard for you to really understand and ingratiate yourself into our political sphere. And I don't know.
That's interesting.
Governance is different. It just is different.
It is. But I think about this all the time too, because, you know, so many candidates run on, I'm a third generation, fifth generation Oklahoman. Sure. I mean, like, it's people who say that don't necessarily have like native roots either.
That's,
I mean, to be fair, like, you know, a lot of Native Americans who live in Oklahoma are here because of the Trail of Tears, and their family is actually from elsewhere. And so, but it is, In fact, just the other day, you know, one of our staff made some crack about, they're from Texas. And I was like, hey, man, like, not everyone from Texas is bad. Like, I'm from Texas. I've been here longer. But I think there is that purity test that does permeate, particularly when it comes to winning over older rural voters, right? Yeah. Who often were like homestead families and share mm-hmm. that identity in some way.
You cannot be a carpetbagger. And, you know, kind of linking back to your Cornette conversation, I think that as much as I adore him, I think that David Holt is going to have that same problem trying to translate on a statewide level whenever he decides in another 10 years that he wants to be governor. You know what I mean? I would love for him to be governor. I love David Holt. I've watched him as a state senator grow into this incredible mayor, right? But I do think that he's going to have that same translation problem, even though he's from Tulsa, right? He's, you know, he's all around.
He's Osage, right? He's been, but he, yeah, I mean, he left and came back, which is goes both ways, I think. But he also is someone who is, I think, anyone from Oklahoma City. There's like a little bit of an element that it hurts them, right? And because with rural areas, I think a lot of voters are skeptical of a city slicker. Sure. They feel is disconnected from their issues. And so I think this is where it's interesting because, you know, Drummond and his family lineage, right, who can lean on that, and someone who's an actual rancher. And I think when you see, to go back to your comments about McCall, when you'd see campaign ads of Drummond and McCall both like on a tractor or in a truck or whatever, one of them looked much more authentic than the other one. Yeah. And so I think that's interesting.
Like near a horse versus on the horse. Like I'm near the horse.
Yeah.
It, right.
I mean, some of it, and I don't know who did the ads, but I just on a pure like political ad lane, there was an ad for Drummond where he's like in his truck and you can like see the barrel of like a shotgun or a rifle, like in the seat next to him. And like, I have very fond and distinct memories of when I was a child living in or being out in small town, East Texas, and going to my great granddaddy's funeral. I was riding with my mom's cousin in his truck who like, you know, gun rack in the window and he had a shotgun in the floor, and then just a pile of Madonna tapes on his seat, like, you know, bench seat. This is like it's like an 85 Chevy. And it was like Guns N' Roses, Madonna. And he was probably, you know, 35 or 40 then. And I was like a little kid, but I was just like, it was very different for me. I mean, I grew up was born in Dallas and we lived in the city some, and we spent a lot of time out in the country, but it was so funny where I was like, this feels very real. And it was just, but, I mean, imagine a candidate today who's driving around in a pickup with a gun rack in there and a bunch of Madonna cassette tapes. Like, this has broad appeal and resonates with a certain audience that, but you can't fake it at all. Like if this was contrived at all, people would see through it immediately.
Yeah, absolutely. Yeah,
well, so you mentioned at the top of the show that non-doc, you know, they had a debate in the primary election for all the or most of the Republican candidates. And during that debate, they asked those on the stage, if you make it to the runoff, will you commit to doing another debate? And I think everybody said yes, including Mike Nasey. So now non-doc and News 9, right, trying to schedule it. And they came back and Drummond's camp said no. But not just that debate. He has not been showing up for other candidate forums. I think he's been sending I've heard he's sending his father as a proxy for some of this, but he seems to not be showing his face in public at a pretty critical time. Right? This is the time you've got to win over people. You can't. And the Drummond campaign statements called it a Joe Biden move, like a straight out of Joe Biden's playbook back from 2020, which was COVID. So everybody was sitting out of their basement. But Biden caught a lot of critique for not campaigning.
As he should.
Right. Do you think that him not doing this debate is actually going to hurt him in the election?
I think that, you know, Macy is trying to craft this message without having to say anything, right? Himself. He's done these very canned interviews. I'm sure you saw News 9 Haley just did sit downs with both of the candidates. He wants to control that message, and kudos to whoever, you know, is running his campaign. That's pretty brilliant, because what we saw in the non-doc debate and some of those other public forums during the primary was that Massey's not that great off the cuff. He comes across as sort of condescending at times. There was a particular exchange with Trey Savage at the non-doc News 9 debate where he sort of made fun of Trey speaking fast and stumbling over his words, which was incredibly cringy to a lot of folks in the audience. You know, it just, he has a combative nature, you know, and debates are, you know, meant to be, but you're also, as a candidate, you're not supposed to be, well, like, okay, let me preface this. In the before times, you know, debates were about getting your point across without having to crush your opponent, right? You can, you know, bring up policy points and, you know, where you're divergent on things, but it's not about, you know, ad hominem personally attacking, you know, the character or the appearance or, you know, whatever of your opponent. And that has really, or the facilitator, moderator of the debate itself. And it feels like that sort of, you know, traditional common sense, you know, civil discourse has gone by the wayside. And I feel like, you know, and that's Massey leaning into, again, national politics, which, you know, we are now having to sort of play that, you know, that tough guy, you know, Trump endorse. You have to keep the Trump endorsement. You have to keep playing the game. You have to keep winning, if you will. And winning is about being punchy. It's about, you know, again, continuously attacking your opponents. I'll be surprised if Drummond does again a cute little nickname for Mike Massey pretty soon, a la Trump, right?
Right. Well, and he, I mean, in the statement about this, Massey's campaign was like, because there's still, he's still agreed to do, I think, one debate on maybe KFOR or somebody. And so his campaign was like, he's still going to show up to debate. He's still going to ask Gittner Drummond why he donated to Joe Biden's campaign. And I think there's, I don't know the number, but I would imagine there's a decent number of Republican voters who don't care about that. Like, they're not thrilled about it, but they also have, like, maybe soured on Trump. Or, I mean, Drummond's just like, hey, listen, I gave to both sides. Or, like, you know, what, yeah. In some ways, that's a shrewd political move.
Which is, yeah, common at a certain level, right? Especially whenever you're in a position where you need to keep all sides, you know, at bay, right? Attorney generals, legal professions, et cetera. That politics doesn't, in terms of policy, those things are, you know, Amazon is going to give to the Republicans and the Democrats, because whoever ends up in the White House or whoever controls the Senate is inevitably going to control the policy. And so that's politics. I'm sorry. I didn't mean to interrupt, but also I've needed to shake about this.
No. So the other, you don't have to apologize. This is a fluid conversation. That's what the listeners are here for. Both of them are here for this kind of banter. The other element here that I think is interesting is Governor Stitt's endorsement, which came out, I guess, this week or last week, but it was, July 2nd. It was. Let's talk about what it wasn't. And I said this on KOSU this week, too. He technically endorsed him, but this is not what most people think of. Like, when I saw the headline, Stitt endorses Massey, I was like, of course, right? Like, Stitt loves Trump. Trump endorsed Massey, ergo, Stitt's got to endorse Massey if he wants to play in the same sandbox.
That's not the math I got. The math I got was Stitt hates Drummond, Stitt's going to endorse Massey.
Right.
That was my.
He could have said nothing. There's options. He could have said nothing.
Yeah, that's true.
Or he could have only, like, attacked Drummond without endorsing Massey, right? Like, the thing was, normally when a politician of that stature, a sitting governor, is going to step in on the race for his replacement, like, if they're going to do anything, it's going to be, I think ideally, it's like a joint event. They're both on stage, they're like holding hands in the air. He's like, let me introduce you to the governor. Like, it's like a big thing. At the very least, it's the governor giving a speech. The governor out somewhere stumping for the person who wants to replace him. That is not the case. This was in a regular, not like a media interview or like a speaking engagement in Duncan, Oklahoma on July 2nd. Not that Duncan's bad, but like not a huge audience, right?
Yeah, right.
And I'm going to read it to you because I think listeners need to hear it. Stitt says, quote, "I was going to wait until the runoff to kind of let the process work." So first of all, he wasn't going to do it. And yet he goes on, "But Mike Mazey is the guy that I think should be the next governor. And he's a little bit goofy. But he's so smart. He's an accountant type. And he served in my cabinet, my budget secretary, blah, blah, blah. So he's like a financial planner, super smart. And we want the kind of person running our $40 billion budget. Not, in my opinion, a trial attorney, right? Because people that sue farmers and ranchers, I don't like that kind of stuff. We want a pro-business governor in there to kind of take the lead for the next 4 years." And so I was just like, this feels like a backhanded compliment where he was like, well, he's a little bit goofy, and but you know, he's so smart. And he's like an accountant type. And I was like, are you complimenting him, or are you trying to like rationalize his goofiness in some way? And like you mentioned earlier, Mazey's presence on stage, and he's had, I think, some gaffes, like his comments about all of the, what did he say? Like
superintendents.
And so I was just like, this is real weird to me in terms of endorsements. And I don't know that Mazey actually wanted Stitt's endorsement, right?
He did.
He did have a statement that was like very...
I would assume.
Yeah. He was like, yeah, hey, thanks, man. And like, we're going to keep fighting, blah, blah, blah. And it was just like, acknowledge it and moved on. I don't think Mazey was seeking the endorsement.
No. Right, because the net, it's like less. He's pulling net. Correct,
Kevin. Right, that's what Pat McFerrin said on the primary night. Was at the time a Stitt endorsement was a -5 impact on Republicans.
So
the race is this quote or this close. Do you think this might hurt Mazey in some way?
No, I don't. So first of all, what a full-throated endorsement of Mike Mazey. I would love for somebody to endorse me and call me a little bit goofy, but smart. All right. That's
make just what I yourself, and it feels real weird, right?
Yeah, totally sus in all the ways, because I think that Kevin Stitt expected to be endorsing Charles McCall, honestly, or a Chip Keating, to be quite honest. I think that this was a surprise for him. And I don't know what else he could have possibly said about Mike Mazey. I doubt very highly, even though he worked in the cabinet, that they were super tight. In a way that, you know, he knows Drummond because he loathes Drummond, right? He said more in that press, in that release about Drummond than he did about Mazey. And so, you know, I don't think it ends up hurting Mazey, because those voters, again, they see past Stitt. It's about the Trump endorsement. They don't really care. I think about Stitt at this point. He is a lame duck. He doesn't like to be called that, but he's done. We'll be good till January.
I think the same thing. I mean, the Trump endorsement, and we've talked about this before, like, obviously that's probably the biggest football in play.
Yeah.
And Mazey got it. And so now Drummond is – but I think we also recognize that, like, the president's only going to endorse one person in a race.
Yeah.
Even if both – and it honestly comes down, I think, to, like, who gave the president the most money. And I mean, it seems – there's some reports, right, that Drummond also donated to Stitt or not Stitt, but to Trump to try to curry some favor. I mean, this president, more so than any other, or at least any other for a long time, is 100% a pay-to-play guy, right? Like, he's like, what can you do for me? And I will consider doing something small for you, like a Truth Social post. And, I mean, it's absolutely nuts that Mazey had paid Roger Stone $70,000-$80,000 basically to get Trump to like tweet out a Truth Social thing. And I'm sure a lot of that money passed through or whatever. But it's just bonkers.
Yeah, it is.
And so, yeah, I'll be really curious to see how this plays out. I mean, I think we know that Stitt doesn't like Drummond. That's not new. So like you said, there was no expectation that he was going to endorse Drummond. I don't know that this gets Mazey anything.
No.
I don't think that it really I mean, there may be a few voters out there that are like, oh, well, the governor likes him. But it's whoever the people are that really like Governor Stitt. And those are probably Tulsa folks, some rural people who like him as a outsider businessman, like that angle.
Maybe some corporations, but
But it's different. I mean, different than when Stitt ran. Mazie does have a history. He was in the state Senate. He was been in the budget in like the finance secretary role. So he has someone who has some experience, but also like can be tied to some of those decisions that might be unpopular with voters. And certainly, going out there and like putting a bunch of local school district superintendents on blast seems like not a winning strategy.
Yeah. So my diatribe about, bringing up Jeopardy earlier, what I was eventually going to get to, was the fact that I'm surprised at this point that, on July 10th, I've not seen yet any negative ads, right? I've not seen any ads, period, for the runoff. I'm at all right now. So I am really interested. I'm thinking maybe next Monday, Tuesday, we'll start to see hopefully some ads. Because I would think at this point that these two gentlemen, I mean, you're seeing Drummond come out and really differentiate himself, right? He is pivoting hard to the center, right? Mm-hmm. And that's going to work. And those 3,500 independents, they're up for grabs, dude. I don't know. This is an interesting race.
Well, I mean, I think it'll work. The question is, will enough of those more moderate Republicans show up in August? Because this is what Mick Cornett tried to do. And I think I just closed those tabs, but I think Mick got like roughly 135,000 votes in the primary, and he only got like 150 something thousand in the runoff. So he didn't gain hardly anything. Like his base was his base, and that kind of maxed him out. And so, we'll see with Drummond here. If he can thread that needle and really kind of straddle the line between, moderate-ish conservative or not like chamber Republican, whatever, whatever the Mitt Romney crowd, whoever the Republicans used to be, pre-Trump Republicans, if he can straddle that with still having some bona fides for the more MAGA crowd, who like him. And there are some single issue voters that this may come down to. And of course, Drummond is still out there suing insurance companies, trying to stand up for the regular man, the working man. I don't know if it'll play out, but we'll see.
Yeah. So, hey, I've got 4 minutes for this data center conversation. I've got that call at 11, I'm sorry, or at 10.
Oh, that's all right. No, we'll finish. Let's just wrap it up there. Let's just say that,
I want to bitch about data centers so bad, man. That's a whole nother fucking podcast.
It is a whole, and we should bring in some other voices for that. Otherwise, we're just complaining ourselves. But the other backdrop for this on elections with endorsements is that we're starting to see a lot of legislators, especially those that are secure, like they don't have challengers, or it's a challenger that they're going to beat pretty handedly, and how they are starting to weigh in. So people like Anthony Moore, we haven't seen Chuck Hall yet, but I wouldn't be surprised. But some of those like people in leadership who are legitimately closer to their voters, right? Like some of these House and Senate members actually do have relationships in their community with business leaders, with chamber crowds, with faith leaders. And if they are the ones that give a measured, appropriate endorsement of one candidate or the other, that could be a big deal. Now, so far, a lot of them are weighing in on other House and Senate races. Like, there's some effort to like take out some more of the Freedom Caucus folks.
Interesting stuff.
Yeah, and so, I mean, I know I'm seeing all of this. I don't know about you, but I've seen all of this in like a lens of this is a bit of a correction, right? Like the legislature as a whole had been going slightly towards the, not hard and slightly, definitely towards the right. This Freedom Caucus has been, I mean, it's been there for almost 10 years now, but had kind of formalized and took a big shift. And then they suffered pretty significant losses in the primary and may suffer more in the runoff. And so it's like a correction back towards whatever the Republicans used to be, in some way. Not, it's like slightly, it's like less MAGA, MAGA light, maybe? I don't right. know.
I would like to see them get back to the Mike Reynolds Liberty Caucus, right? The Liberty and the Freedom Caucus is, right, the nationalized, the MAGA sort of iteration of that Liberty Caucus. Mike Reynolds used to run around with, you know, Robert's Rules in his, you know, front pocket, man. He was a parliamentarian at heart. He would object for hours, right, and just hold up the process. That's what, like, the Liberty Caucus, right, the super conservative yeah. caucus used to be, right? Those were the good old days. And they were not necessarily legitimized by their more moderate peers. Even T.W. Shannon, right, was Speaker of the House at the time, and right. stopped Mike Reynolds' personhood bill legislation from being run on the House floor. I don't know if you people remember legislative history, but I was
yeah,
there.
Yeah.
And so we've got completely different sort of flavors right now that I think are, they're too far to the right. Mm-hmm. And I think, you know, whenever, you know, Devers and his group went, you know, full on abolitionist, it wasn't just enough that we have the, you know, strictest abortion ban in, you know, along with Texas, et cetera, in the nation. It's when it, you know, we need to criminalize and we need to, you know, do all of these extra things. Folks were like, oh, wait a minute. This is not exactly what I think. And especially those younger conservatives. It's the same thing that we saw, especially on the issue of abortion and bodily sovereignty. It's sort of the same thing we saw in Kansas, for example, right? Bloody red state just to the north of us. You know, one would have thought that on a ballot initiative, you know, on abortion, enshrining it in their constitution, that based on their state politics, they would have handily voted that down, right? But instead, this newer generation of conservatives that make up a large part of the electorate in states like Kansas and Oklahoma, they said, nah, bro, this is, the government should not be in my business anyway. Like, you should not reach out and touch my body, right? Yeah. And policy on my body. So I think this is a reckoning that a lot of both parties are going to have to deal with. I think the Democrats have the advantage because they've elected younger folks into the party, right? And ingratiated a lot of younger, our generation, elder millennials and younger, right? Maxwell Frost, Gen Z. But I think the conservatives have been really slow to this, right? The Charlie Kirk movement is really young, to be honest, right? The Turning Point movement is really young comparatively to the one that Obama started, you know, yeah. in 2008. And so they are having to catch up and to really understand this generational politics that we are playing at this point. So,
yeah.
That's what I got, man.
That's great. Man. Well, we'll find out what happens in a month. Emily, thanks for being here today.
Thank you.
Listeners, thanks for being here as well. It's a big time to get involved. We've got voter registration things happening all the time. Please go to letsfixthis.org to get involved. We need volunteers. We need help. We're trying to do a full court press on getting people to turn out because voting matters. As we say every week, decisions are made by those who show up. Find a way to show up this week.